I'm Dimitri, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dimitri.
I thought I was nervous, and then I put this on, and then I really got nervous. I'm really glad to be here tonight. It's funny the way life works. Last night, I was sitting around joking with a friend, and I was like, man, I say no to AA when I want, like, totally kidding. And then 5 minutes later, I get this text, will you come and do the 10-minute share at this meeting? And I'm like, of course. Let's see. My sobriety date is April 20th, 2015. I just celebrated a year. I have a sponsor that I speak to regularly, and I sponsor other women in this program. And I'm going to try and keep it at 10 minutes. I'm from Marin County, born and raised there. My mom got sober when I was about 13, so I grew up knowing what AA was. AA was a place where people that drank too much came and then they got better. I didn't really know about the steps or anything. There was a pinball machine in the Marin Alana Club when I was a kid, so I just played Star Wars pinball a lot. But like, I feel like the seed was planted, and like most people talk about, it felt really uncomfortable growing up, and I wanted to get out of myself. Like, my parents divorced, and I always felt different, and probably around the time that my parents divorced when I was 13 and my mom got sober is when I started getting curious about drugs and alcohol. But since my mom had a problem with drinking, I wanted to stay away from that. I don't know why, because I don't think it was because I thought I had a problem with it, but I was like, you know, that would be bad. Like, that would be disrespectful. So I did all the things I could but that until came the day when, like, it was offered to me and I said yes, which is kind of the story of how my drinking and using went. I changed high schools because I thought the high school I was at was a problem. The high school I went to was even worse, so I went back, and when I got back, like, I'd burned all the bridges of people that I'd made there, so that was, like, even worse, because everyone's like, what the fuck are you doing back here? And so I decided that I would leave high school early, and that would solve all my problems, because I was going to move to San Francisco, and, like, start this whole life, and everything was going to be great. And that plan got changed when I got diagnosed with end-stage liver disease because of an autoimmune disorder, and I spent 6 weeks in the hospital, and I got a liver transplant when I was 17. And they gave me this whole kind of spiel afterwards, like, you know, take your meds, get your blood work done, never drink or do drugs, or you'll die. And I was kind of like, okay, I can do that. Like, you know, this whole alcoholism thing that runs in my family, I'm going to dodge that. So cool. And that worked for a couple years, until eventually it didn't. Like, that was kind of the way that I used that to, like, stand out as, like, oh, I can't do those things, like, because I'm really special, and I had this life-changing experience, and and then that got really old, and then it was like, yeah, I can't do this, blah, blah, blah. Like, it wasn't as much of a party trick anymore, and so then, like, I was somewhere and was giving someone my spiel about why I couldn't hit the joint they were trying to give me, and he was like, dude, my friend had a liver transplant and he smokes weed. And so that was reason enough for me, like, oh, cool, like, this random dude knows another random dude that had a liver transplant and he smokes weed, so I'm fine. And so that started that, and the ball just kept rolling, and I kind of kept with, like, oh, as long as I don't drink, everything will be fine. And, you know, so it was like, just weed at first and then other drugs, and then came the day when I didn't have, like, the things I needed to feel the way I wanted to feel, and I drank, and that sucked, and I said I'd never do it again, and then I kept saying that for about 9 months every morning when I woke up, and I always had, like, a reason, you know, like, oh, it's because I didn't eat anything before I drank last night, or, like, I went to this bar, I was with these people. And very quickly, my world became very small because all of my friends had seen me go through this this really life-changing experience. They'd sat by my hospital bed, and now I was like, let's take shots. And they were like, you cannot do that. So instead of thinking about my behavior, I just changed the people I hung out with, and that made my life really small. And you know, I messed around. Like, I thought about getting sober. I did an outpatient program, and they, like, you know, I wanted to do it my own way, and that wasn't working, so I ditched that. And eventually, I started coming around AA, but I didn't take it too seriously. And when I had, like, 30 or 40 days, I met a guy in a meeting that was into heroin. And we, you know, I obviously loved him because we've known each other for 2 weeks. And he showed me how to get loaded on heroin. And I lost everything in about 2 weeks. I lost my job, my apartment. I pawned all the things that I could. I'd called every person that owed me like $5 or more and gotten that $5 to $40 back from them so I could get loaded, and was homeless for about 6 months until I really decided like I need to go back to AA. And that was in 2010. And I came crawling back, and I was super willing, and I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps, and my life got really good really quick. And I started sponsoring women, and then like I got into another program around food because I decided I didn't like the way I looked. And I kind of just was like building this life that I thought was really pretty. Like I was really skinny and I was in general service, and I had a bunch of sponsees, and I was like the head hostess at this fancy restaurant, and I was getting A's in school, and it looked really good. Like, you guys would have been impressed. And that was cool for a while. That worked for a couple years, until it didn't. And I, you know, things started to get funny. Just around like my program, I wasn't going to as many meetings. Like, I was rolling my eyes when my sponsees called me instead of picking up their calls. My eating disorder really kicked up, and that was a big place of shame for me. And because I had this pretty life that I thought you guys were all really impressed with, I didn't want any of you to know that. So, you know, my idea was just to kind of isolate until I could get everything back to being really pretty, and then I'd come back and be with you guys. And that didn't work. I always, like, whenever I talked about, oh, if I'd ever get loaded again, like, I'll never smoke weed because weed's dumb. Like, I do heroin. The first time I relapsed, I smoked weed with a guy named Josiah, who sells bacon at the farmer's market. I thought he was cute, and I liked to buy bacon from him, and he asked me if I wanted to smoke weed, and I said yes. And it sucked. Like, man, after you don't smoke weed for a long time, and the way the weed is these days, I was, like, so high. It was worse than not being high. And I called my sponsor, and I cried. And, you know, we talked about, like, at least I didn't do, like, drugs, I didn't shoot heroin, all these things, like, I can get back on the horse, it's gonna be fine, and I'm like, call someone and go to a meeting, and I kind of had to, like, look through my phone for a while to be like, ugh, like, I see all the people with AA next to their name, and I was like, I don't really want to call you, and the first person that I decided I did want to call and picked up the phone was like, yeah, come to this meeting in the city tonight, and I was like, great, I kind of slept off the weed, and I was feeling, like, really hopeful for the rest of my recovery to continue on. And then I was on the Golden Gate Bridge, and this feeling just came over my body that I absolutely had to get some heroin. But I was like, well, I've been sober for, like, almost four years, and, you know, I don't really want to go into the Tenderloin after dark, and this meeting's at 8 o'clock, so I better, like, go get some stuff before the meeting. And so I did that, and I go to this meeting, and I, like, cry, then I'm a newcomer, and all these women hug me. And, you know, I talk about how much I want to be in AA, but, like, the reality was it was on. I went home and just, like, it was terrible. And my life went like that for, like, about for 9 months, where I would say I really, really wanted to get sober, and I just couldn't. I didn't want to be honest about the things that were happening in my life, and I really love the first step because it's two parts that my life, or that my, oh, my God. Powerless over alcohol, and that my life had become unmanageable. And I was definitely powerless over alcohol. But for me, I was like, but my drinking is unmanageable. Like, I still kind of like the way I can mess around with my eating disorder, and, like, dating still kind of works a little bit. Not really. Like, Tinder in and out of sobriety is really weird. And it just kept taking me to a lot of really dark places. And I kept showing up here because I didn't know what else to do. And I kept not wanting to be fully honest with what was going on with me. Like, I wanted to, like, I would come to a meeting and be like, I relapsed again, but it's okay. And, like, have a smile on my face when really what I needed to be, you know, was to do was be vulnerable and say, like, I feel like I want to kill myself. My life is fucked. And in and out, like, why I'm about using. I was so lonely. I didn't have any friends because I'd been in AA for so long. So, like, I'd go on a run and tweak for a couple days, and then I'd be like, oh, it's Friday at 8:30. Like, everyone's going to be at the ice cream parlor. And I'd show up at the ice cream parlor, like, for company because people were fellowshipping there after a meeting. And, yeah, I did, like, a couple day treatment programs, and nothing worked until I don't know, I just woke up one morning and I was really ready. I was ready to say, like, my drinking is unmanageable, my eating disorder is unmanageable, like, I can't do any of it anymore. It's not, I have no ideas left. You know, I had to get to a place where I was willing to be honest about all of it, and show up here and say I don't know anything anymore, and I need your help. And that's when it really started working for me. Like, I did an outpatient eating disorder program, and I showed up for meetings, and when people asked me what was different, I was honest with them, because I never wanted anyone to know that I struggled around food. For me, that was, like, super embarrassing, and now, I mean, it doesn't bother me at all. But yeah, and this year has been one of the most amazing years of my life, really, and I've just, like, been living in remembering that not only is my drinking and using unmanageable, my life is unmanageable, and I've got to walk through a lot of painful and uncomfortable things, and also a lot of really beautiful things have happened as a result of working this program and just staying here, and, you know, showing up no matter what, like, no matter how I feel, no matter what my head tells me I look like or feel like, I'm just here, and I talked to my sponsor. I've got to make amends to my mom, like, 2 days before we have the shared birthday. So it was, like, my sobriety birthday and the day before her birthday, I got to make amends to her. Because last year on her birthday, she wanted nothing to do with me because it was, like, I'd so many times called her and been like, I need help again. And it was just old and she was over it. And so it was really beautiful to get to make that amends to her and show up and like, be a family member. And, yeah, like, I just don't have a whole lot of things that I feel shame about anymore, and I never thought that that was something I would have. I just lived with so much shame before, and it's so cool, just from showing up, like, one of the things, I didn't really know how much shame I held around it until I got to release it. Last week, I went to a CHIP meeting, and when I was in day treatment, I met a girl, and we really hit it off, and we were kind of like, you know, we were sober buddying, and she would slip, and I would slip, and then eventually we slipped together, and I held this shame around, like, using with someone that had been in AA, and I called her phone every couple months, had been disconnected, and, like, I talked to my sponsor about it, and, like, how am I going to make this amends, and I'm walking down the aisle, like, just, like, do-do-do, getting another chip, because I wanted to get all the one-year chips, and I looked, and she's walking next to me. And it was just, like, such a beautiful moment, like, to feel that kind of last bit of shame from the things I admitted on my fourth and fifth step, dissipate, you know, like, oh, I'm not a bad person for the things I did when I was using, and I can see this woman that I love dearly and, you know, see the miracle happen for her and not have to, like, feel like I was a bad part of her life, and yeah, I'm just really grateful to be here, so thank you. It looks great on you.
Yeah.
Where does this go?
In the pocket, yeah.
Oh, my name is Mac. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mac.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, that was great. How about that? Demetra said it twice. It worked until it didn't. Kind of the story of my life. very happy to be sober with you here tonight. It's not a punishment. I'm not missing anything. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a chance to start all over again and try and do it right this time. The end of my drinking, well, the long period that was the end of my drinking, I didn't have a mailing address and I was mostly living in a car. And I used to sit in that car, no radio, so I was sitting there in dead silence with the bottle for years, and I would think, gosh, if I could just start all over again, if I could just do this all over again, I mean, I didn't really know it at the time, but I was thinking, well, I could figure out how to drink. But basically what I meant was, you know, if I could just do this all over again, I wouldn't make the mistakes that I made before, and I would not be sitting here like I am now. And, you know, then when I came to AA, they said, you have to start all over again. And I was like, oh, no, no, no. I'm not going to do that. And consequently, I stayed drunk in AA, would drink before meetings and certainly after meetings. Very painful to be here for 3.5 years. That was over in Hayward. I live in San Francisco now, so you know. I see a few people here that I've seen on my journey. Emily, Natalie, Chris, Jay. Thank you for asking me to speak, Trevor. A lot of new people. Welcome to the fun house. We have this thing here that we metaphorically call the lifeboat. I never wanted to get in it. A lot of crazy people in that boat. It never docks. But if you get in the middle of the boat, there's no booze in the boat. If you get in the middle of this thing, decide that you're not going to get out of the boat, you're safe from alcohol for today. You get a chance to recover. I wanted what you people had from the minute I walked into AA, but I wanted to be loaded while I got it. And it didn't work. I don't believe that I was born an alcoholic. It just doesn't feel that way to me. However, I have never met my biological father, so there could be a whole group of people that are all dead or suffering that I don't know anything about. But I chose to investigate drugs and alcohol. I held out as long as I could, and then I drank when I was 13. And it gave me power. Even looking back on it now, I feel like I was a pretty together kid. Like in those days, I was not afraid of anything. You know, years of alcohol abuse made me afraid of an awful lot of stuff that I never felt that way about before. But alcohol definitely gave me power. It made me feel like I was more than I was. Like I kind of liked myself, but when I drank, I felt like everything I liked about me was even bigger. And the things that I didn't like about me and you and the world were not so big. And it gave me a real fuel. For a long time, I thought, wow, you know, I am an expert drinker. And this is really working out. And when things aren't quite going my way, I can make it in my mind seem like they're more going my way. And I was on kind of a trajectory of success in this world. And, you know, basically due to my family's outrageously strict upbringing, which I now see as, you know, I got to learn an awful lot of stuff about how to actually deal with life that I rejected back then. And have had to kind of pick up again. You know, it's funny, there are new people here, so I know what you're thinking. A lot of old, conservative ideas in AA. That's because they work. They've been around a lot, like thousands of years, people have been living on these principles that we have around here. And I wanted to be that. You had this haircut, kind of. But I still wanted to be, like, radical. Yeah. Actually, for us, not drinking is the most radical thing there is. This is a radical life. The nerdiest person in Alcoholics Anonymous has already lived a more radical life than 99% of the people out there. So here we are together. But when I came to AA, that's not what I thought. I thought old ideas, I rejected all that stuff a long time ago. But I knew I was supposed to be here. So I have to say, drinking was fun and useful until it wasn't. And I remember when I realized I was an alcoholic. In looking back on it, just like it says in the book, I undoubtedly crossed the line long before I was aware of it. But I do remember the day that I was supposedly in law school, except I wasn't going anymore. And I would get up early in the morning and drink. I always drank in the morning, had no rules whatsoever about drinking. I until I tried to quit, and I tried to impose a whole bunch of rules that didn't work, but I had no rules. I always drank in the morning. The second time I drank in the morning. It was the best time. Worked the best. Nice way to start the day. And so I was drinking in the mornings, and I was getting up real early to watch Little House on the Prairie about 6 o'clock in reruns because, like, I could empathize with that family. So Laura Ingalls was my lower companion. And I could sort of, like, half cry. Somebody else had it worse off than me. And one morning I woke up and, you know, a very spiritual program, actually. I kind of think the whole idea of a spiritual life was working on me a long time before I picked it up. But I was sick one day. I thought I had the flu. Oh, my gosh, I feel terrible. I can't seem to get this alcohol down. And I was a daily drinker, like all day, for a long time, which is why I was not at law school. The people had my number. I was walking behind this girl one day, and she said, "He never even finishes his sentences." And finally, I got enough alcohol in me that morning. This would have been about 1986, to get well. And suddenly, I was not sick anymore, and I wasn't throwing up, and I felt all calm and everything. And I thought, "Uh-oh!" Like I knew enough about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the after-school specials they had when I was a kid. Dawn, Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic. which had very interesting depictions of AA in it. The one with the little kid, he was like 10, and he had a year. Remember that one? Anyway, I knew enough about alcoholism to realize this was a sign of someone who's physically addicted to alcohol. You feel sick, you drink, you don't feel sick. The alcohol is curing you. And I thought, oh no, but I was an expert drinker. What happened? Because I knew people who had trouble with drinking, and I drank just like they did. And whenever I wanted, I could put it down. And my first thought was, how am I, you know, I'm out of school, I don't have a job, I'm hiding from the world, I'm going to lose this place where I'm living in about 6 months. How am I going to stay drunk now for the rest of my life? That was my thought. Not, uh-oh, I better give this up, it's causing me a problem, but uh-oh, what do I do now? I've got myself in a pickle. And yeah, the big alcoholic life, lie. It'll never get worse than this. That's what I thought. Straight downhill from there. And I was very addicted to alcohol, and when I wanted to put it down, I couldn't. And I had withdrawal seizures and all kinds of things happened. I didn't have a liver transplant, but when I went to the doctor, you have a seizure, and you get in an ambulance, or you end up at the emergency room, and they start asking you questions like, they want to know if you have brain damage. So they start asking you, who's the governor? What was the last holiday? All this kind of stuff. And I would tell them, look, I don't think I have brain damage, but I don't read the newspaper. I don't watch TV. So I was living in my car. I don't watch TV. I don't go to the movies. I don't know the answers to any of these questions. And then the doctor would say, if you drink again, you might die. And I would be lying there thinking, you do not understand. If I don't get a drink, I feel like I'm going to die. That's how it was. You know, that whole, I was just like, for the long, long time that was the end of my drinking, I was pushing away detox. It was absolutely no fun. I wasn't getting really drunk anymore. And I was just trying not to be sick all the time. And I couldn't hold a job. And my family didn't have anything to do with me after a while. And, you know, I guess we always have to back up. So I will back up to when I came to AA, which was before that time that I started having all the seizures, because I had my first seizure in Red Bluff, up at my grandparents' house in Northern California. And they were popular people in the place, you know, and it was not exactly a place to have, everybody in the small town knew them, and I was sneaking around the alleys, and, you know, I had a seizure there, and the ambulance came, and they tried to help me until they couldn't help me anymore, and they said, you got to get out of here. My mother said, you can come back down to the Bay Area as long as you go to a recovery program, which didn't sound very appealing to me, but yeah, I was like kind of not in control of what was going on, and I was still robbing them, so I figured somehow I was going to continue to have access to their money. And I went to this 28-day program, doesn't exist anymore, and I was in there and they told me all about alcoholism. They made us go to AA, and it was the longest period of time that I had been clean and sober since I was 13, and I thought, this is for me, thank God. I finally got to the point where I have excised alcohol from my life, because I thought that was the problem. I thought if I can just get booze out of my life, I can go back to, you know, being all successful. And so I told them, no, I don't need to go to your halfway house. Actually, I agreed to go live with my mother, which was a gargantuan mistake, because she was one of these people who had also watched Little House on the Prairie or something, and her idea of getting an alcoholic sober was to make you work it off. You know? So I'd be out there, like, mowing the lawn, you know, with the big machine going to eat me, and worse to go there than to just sit in my car and detox like I did a bunch of different times. I was up there in that 28-day program, and I thought, great, I will never drink again. I'm not going to do what they say. I don't really like this AA thing. I'm not going to go to that, and I'm not going to go to the halfway house that they want me to go to, and I'm not going to get this support or anything, but I'm never going to drink again. Wow, isn't this great? And I walked out on day 29, and I opened the door, and there was my life. No job, no career path, no money. No real place, you know, no place that I wanted to go, and it was too much for me, and I walked straight across the street and bought a bottle. And that's when I started coming to AA loaded, and people here really, really tried to help me. Many, many people said, you can come stay in my house. It was a slightly different fellowship than the one that I'm in now, and they were much more understanding, it seemed like. A lot of people helped me out, and they said, you can come and live in my house. The only rule is you don't drink. And my whole idea was the only reason I'm trying to get into your house is so I can drink out inside. You know? And you got a TV. When I was living in the car, oh my God, I would get money together to go to a motel just to watch TV and drink. And I burned a lot of those people. And years later, I tried to find them so that I could make amends to them. And didn't find a lot of them. That's what happens around here. I had a sponsor at that time that that had me arrested. He said, you can come stay in my warehouse. I know you're living in your car. You can stay in my warehouse anytime you want. You know, there's a bathroom in there. You can stay for a night, is what he meant. Gave me the keys, and I moved in. I mean, that was, you know. And after a couple months of that, one night, I was sneaking in there with a 12-pack, and all the lights went on, and there he was. And he said, I know what you've been doing, and I would not give him the key back. Kind of a famous guy in AA now, really. His name's Tall Paul. And he called the police, which I thought at the time was like the least AA thing you could possibly do. Till years later I read in the book, once in a while you may have to call the police. Yeah, it made sense. And they arrested me, and I had been to law school, so when the big giant Bull Dyke cop was smashing my face into the gravel, I was like, what are you arresting me for? And she said, drunk in public. And I said, we're in an industrial park. This isn't public. I was screaming, you know, there's no public out here. They didn't care. And I couldn't get out of the drunk tank. I hadn't even drank that 12-pack. And they kept testing me and testing me and testing me. I was in there for like almost 2 days. But the 12-pack was in my car. And so when I got out of jail, I went straight there and got away as fast as I could. And was running for a long time. And I was very sick. You know, I would drink to the label of whatever kind of bottle I had, whether it was a bottle of vodka or a 40-ouncer or whatever it was. And it became like learned behavior, Pavlovian. You know, I could drink to the label, and then I threw that up, and then I could keep drinking. So I was living in that car, and I would go park behind the Southland Mall in Hayward by the Lucky Store there, and I always parked in the same spot. Like, there was shade there at certain times during the day, so I kept parking in the same spot, and I was living in this car that had this great seat that just reclined. You just pull one thing, it reclined all the way back, so you could lean, throw up out the door, you could pee out the door, you know. And so there developed this giant vomit spot. It just kept growing, because I kept going back to the same place, you know. And they say, you know, big important world events, you'll never forget where you were. The 1989 earthquake, that's where I was. At the vomit spot. And I began to think that I couldn't get sober. You know, that's how it began to feel. And people told me, you need to come to a lot of meetings, and you need to get a sponsor, and you need to... I don't know, it's odd. I kind of feel like they didn't talk that much about the steps. But I was drunk all the time, so I really don't know what they were talking about. But, you know, it seemed to me that you just came to AA and sat here and somehow were miraculously lifted up into a life beyond your wildest dreams. That's what I thought. That's what it looked like. And but people did tell me you need to be, you know, getting some commitments around here maybe, and, you know, you need to go to a lot of meetings, and you need to do these things that we do. And I was thinking, yeah, but, like, I need to be drunk to do that. I need a big glass of vodka before I can go do these things that you want me to do. And I didn't understand it. And also, I didn't want to understand it. But I came to meetings. I went to a lot of meetings because I knew this was the place that would have me. And what eventually happened was I ended up going through a couple of recovery programs over on the peninsula and a halfway house and all this stuff. And I would sneak drinks in there. I was like president of the halfway house, running the meetings loaded. And very painful, I have to say. There could be some, you know, we do this thing. Are we all, over here in Oakland, though, they say, did we all make it to a meeting tonight? Which is what I like when they have the birthday countdown. But I hear frequently, are we all sober tonight? You know, and I think, probably not. Probably not. And so in all these places, I was getting loaded still, and I had all the phony chips, because I had to lie to people, but I never really had the time that I was supposed to have. And I was living in this clean and sober hotel after going through this recovery center circuit for a while, and I could sneak all the bottles and the cans in, but I never had the wherewithal to take them out. So I was in this little tiny room with those big giant lawn garbage bags full of old cans and bottles, and they caught me. Apparently it was like reeking out the door. And they sent me on the, it's called the MAP van, Mobile Assistance Patrol, to the Osnom Center. This was in July of 1990, and it was the last time I drank. It is not my sobriety date, but it is the last time that I drank. And I think it was just like such a horrible experience that when I came out of there and nobody would have me back, the halfway house wouldn't take me back, and I had lost both of the jobs that I had, and I was going to be sent to a homeless shelter over at Geary and Polk in San Francisco, which was a new thing for me, although I had been like pseudo-homeless for a long time. And I was walking up 9th Street with a suitcase, little suit, ratty suitcase held together by safety pins with everything that I owned in it. And I was willing, for a moment, I was willing to, I don't care if I never have any friends again, I don't care if I have to work at a horrible job, I don't care if I have to go to this AA thing, I don't care if I have to live in that homeless shelter forever, I just never want to drink again. And that moment of surrender was enough of a miracle to keep me from drinking. White knuckles. And, like, I still didn't like AA, and like I told you, I had a sponsor that had me arrested, so there was no way in the world I was going to get a sponsor, but I kept going to AA for a little while, and I was, like, 6 months clean and sober for the first time in a long time, and I thought, you know what, I need to relax, I better smoke a little weed. You know, within instantly, 18 hours a day with a pipe in the pocket, the bong in the trunk, and, you know, the blood living on Visine, and still going to this job, and my life just became nothing for years, nothing. 7.5 years I lived like that, and I never saw anybody but the dealer, and he would really only come to me. He delivered because I was practically paying his rent. And you can only, you know, you can only smoke so much weed. An alcoholic of my type, you can only smoke so much weed. I never got the oblivion that I wanted. And after a number of years, I felt like, I'm going to drink. That's exactly how I felt. It's coming. I know it's coming. I need to get back into AA and get a chip. That was my idea. Because I didn't want anybody to know that I had been doing that. And I told everybody, oh, I haven't had a drink for 5 years. I haven't had a drink for 7 years. Because a lot of people knew I was supposed to be sober. And I had had what would have been, you know, the phony 8-year birthday. And this guy that I know, who I was working with, he disappeared. He came back. He had been getting sober. And he came up to me at work and he said, I hear that you don't drink. And I said, oh, I haven't had a drink for 8 years. And he said, great, will you come speak at my meeting on Wednesday night? And just utterly fucked me up. His part of his idea of the story is that I started crying and everything. It's not true. Not but it did mess me up. And I have been trying to, you know, I've been reading the Came to Believe book. I thought, okay, even if this is a spiritual thing, I will even do the spiritual thing. And he said, just come back, you know, and I told him the truth. And he said, just come back to AA. And I had a friend. And it was really my sobriety, that's how it started. God put a friend in my life that it was okay to go back with. And I knew that I was going to have to do everything that those people had told me to do, or I was probably going to drink again. And I started doing that, and it was painful. And I had been hooked on that pussy drug marijuana. And I wasn't coming back to life. You know, it was like I couldn't sleep without it. I couldn't eat without it. I couldn't think without it. And the first sponsor I had said, just wait, things will clear up. At about 6 months, everything just became brutally clear. And my whole life just came swarming back on me. And, you know, I have a friend who says that it takes us a long time just to get to regular. You know, we have all these great ideas of what we're going to do, but sit back and recover for a while first. And that first sponsor that I had told me, you know, I say all the time, I was saying, I'm so uncomfortable and I still don't like these people. And I haven't been to a movie in forever or read a book, so I can get as far as, how are you doing? I'm okay. But then beyond that, I have nothing to talk about. I haven't been doing anything. He said, work your way through Alcoholics Anonymous 12 steps and you will feel comfortable in any meeting in the world. And that's been my experience. That's the common language that I have here. I used to just bore people to death. I had nothing else to say but what step I'm on and all my ideas about it and what this person had said and how great they covered it in the meeting. And somebody just wanted to, you know, talk about whatever was on TV. And but I did, you know, get some kind of foundation in that. And I'm now 17 years clean and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life is great as long as I'm willing to see it that way. I found out that I am not a very restless person. I really don't get irritated that often, but lots of times I'm discontented. That's how it is. Just want to tweak everything just a little bit more to my liking, which is why alcohol works so well. You know, no wonder. I was that way when I was a little kid. Just a little bit more the way I like it. But I used that up, you know, and so I began to practice the steps and find out that, you know, I am, it's not going to change. It's been a long time since I had a drink, but I remember exactly what it feels like to tell myself, I'm going to have one drink so I can relax enough to stop drinking. That's what I used to think. And have that much of the first one, it was always a big drink, but still, that much of the first one left and be already in the second drink. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous and God and the people that I have around me and the steps and all that stuff give me enough power to stay away from the first drink, but I know very well that there is no power in the universe that can keep me away from the second drink. That's all there is to it. I'm an alcoholic and I can feel that in my bones. I know exactly what that's like, and I never want to go back to that. And just knowing that isn't enough. At all. Just knowing it is not enough. I got to live this life. And turns out that it's a really great life. I thought it was exactly what I did not want. And it turns out that all along, this is what I was looking for. And my sponsor said, it's like a map. If you want to get, you have these ideas of what your life could be, what it would be like without a drink, and all this stuff. If you want to get there, you need to know where you are now. And so here's a blank piece of paper, and, you know, constantly inventory, until I thought I was going to die, 4 through 9. And things did not seem like they were getting very much better for a long time. And I was a year and a half sober, and I went to the World Conference in Minneapolis with my two very best friends in AA. They're still my friends now. We've all stayed sober. It's a miracle of my life, these two guys. Worst 8 days I ever had in my life, you know, because I had all these ideas of what it was going to be, and they didn't want to follow the plan. And I hated those guys. You know, we went to Las Vegas afterwards. Worst, oh, nightmare. My sponsor, I called up my sponsor. I said, I'm having a miserable time punctuated by tolerable moments. Write an inventory and share it with one of those people at that conference. I did that. Didn't work at all. Yeah. But what happened was that I began to go through the steps and to begin to get a power greater than me in my life that I could rely on. And I began to be able to talk about people. And I was comfortable at meetings. And I began to feel like this was the place where I was really supposed to be and that it was good for me. And at 4.5 years sober, my sponsors, I had another blank piece of paper that was supposed to be the things that I like to do. And it was blank for like 2 years. I was like, I really don't like to do it. Finally, I put a drink on it. And actually, he did not think that was funny at all. So he said, okay, well, if you don't, what would you like to do that you don't like to do? And maybe you might want to go back and recapture some of the things that you threw away for a bottle. And I thought, well, okay, school. So I went back to school, on and on and on. School. I went and got a master's degree in order to get grades to go back to law school. And my old law school wouldn't take me back. It had been all those years. And another place took me, and I went through school. And got the degree, and all felt great. I've made amends to myself. Yeah. And in February, I took the California bar exam for the 6th time. Like, okay, God, it's really not funny anymore. But, you know, I will tell a quick story. See if I can do it in a couple minutes. I don't give up anymore around here because I don't know when the work that I do is going to materialize. When I was smoking weed, my mother, who was a first grade teacher, and I had always helped her with her classroom since I was a little boy, and she relied on that. And for a while there, I wasn't drinking, and things between me and her were actually better. And she called me, Halloween was coming up in 1990, and she said, can you come out and help me set up the room for Halloween? And I knew I'd been smoking so much weed that I was going to have to, it wasn't going to work like 2 days later when she wanted me to come, and I was putting her off, and I was putting her off, because I needed to like whittle down a little before I could spend 8 hours in her classroom. And we had this thing, no matter how bad it goes, we never hang up on each other. She would always stand outside her house and wave to me, and she was very sick. And I said, no, I won't come. Put my foot down. And she hung up on me for the first time ever in my life and died the next morning. And I thought that was something I would never be able to get over. You know, I got like all kinds of Freudian thoughts and all, you know, all this stuff. When I finally came around to the ninth step, I tried to make amends to her grave a couple of different times, tried to treat people differently than I had treated her, and it wasn't going away. You know, I felt like, wow, this is something that's going to haunt me forever. And when I was 3 years sober, and I had done all those inventories, and I had done all this service and all kinds of work in AA, my grandmother was sick. She was 95 years old, and she was dying, and she didn't want me to come up and see her in the way that she was. And I called up there, and I had said a great big prayer before, and I had made amends to her, too. But, you know, like grandmothers are, she said, oh, it's all water under the bridge. We don't care. I was like, yeah, well, first of all, you do care. That's not helping me out. But I didn't know what to say. And I think that AA gives me this way of sometimes being a good person in spite of myself, mm-hmm. in a way to kind of make up for the stuff that I used to do. I will never come out ahead. I treated the world and other people like crap, all for my own sake. It'll never balance out even, but I remembered that when I didn't know what I was going to say. And I remember that she used to quote this little poem to me when I went to bed, when I would stay up there at her house, so that I would remember her. And it's, I will tell you what it is, even though it's hokey. It's Longfellow. It's silently, softly, in the infinite meadows of heaven, blossom the lovely stars, the forget-me-nots of the angels. And that came to me. And I said it to her, and she died the next morning. And I felt like, wow, I had to wait all this time, but my mother's death and so many of this crap, the ways that I had treated my family, disappeared. I don't have that. I have cleaned away enough of my past, so there's nothing haunting me that I need to drink about. Nothing haunting me anymore. I still have the present, though. And I can be haunted by something that happened at noon. And AA gives me a way to deal with that. Part of it is I don't give up. Keep coming back. Keep coming back to the meeting. Keep coming back to my sponsor. Keep coming back to the guys that I sponsor. Keep coming back to my breath in the 11th step. Miracle shit around here. And it's so easy. Don't leave. Keep coming back. Thank you very much.